Greg Berg is next. Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for The Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I am delighted to welcome back into our studios a very good friend to the morning show here at WGTD, a faculty colleague of mine, Dr. Art Sear, director of the A.W. Clausen Center for World Business, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business, author of After the Cold War, a columnist whose essays appear in newspapers and journals here and abroad. And as many of you know, if you regularly listen to The Morning Show, Dr. Art Sear joins me once a month to talk about issues both here and abroad. And Professor Sear, it's great to have you back on The Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg, especially for your very generous introduction. That's why I come back.
Okay. All right. Well,
That's not the only reason.
Right. Well, you and I, of course, are coming off of a big weekend at Carthage College, namely commencement weekend. And for Carthage, of course, it was an especially exciting commencement exercise in that we were privileged to have on the stage the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Paul Ryan, who also happens to be our representative to the House
yes,
of Representatives,
as
President Woodward mentioned in his introduction. I know that you were excited about the fact that someone of Speaker Ryan's stature was appearing on our stage. Not that he hasn't been there before, but he's never been there before as Speaker of the House. Just wonder what your thoughts are.
Well, I'm very glad he appeared at Carthage. And as I mentioned on the radio up in Milwaukee and directly to President Woodward, I think he and his immediate staff should be commended and congratulated for having Congressman Ryan with us. It was a major accomplishment and very, very fine for Carthage and for our community.
I know that one of the things that, you know, ended up, you know, raising some maybe questions and concerns was just the fact that we're, of course, in the middle of what just seems to be an increasingly rancorous and unsettling political battle here in the country, and politics are particularly divisive. But of course, Speaker Ryan, on this occasion, was not entering into any of that, and gave a speech that was very much focused on the new graduates and the new lives ahead of them, and there was scarcely a whiff of partisan politics in anything he had to say.
The best politicians, from my perspective, in this country especially, are those who are able to develop empathy for not only get the job done, but also empathy for people. And I believe he alluded to the fact that he's no longer young, and neither are you and I, but the turbulence and turmoil in a very positive way and the uncertainty of just finishing college and entering out, especially into the job market, but also life, including personal life, I thought he did a very good job of capturing that phase in people's lives. And you're quite right, he was not partisan and he was not short-sighted or self-centered, and that's all to the good. But I thought, I do have vague memories of when I was finishing college during a very turbulent time in American life, I might add, in the 60s. I thought he said a lot of very very helpful things, including, especially in an open society, be prepared for abrupt change, be prepared for disappointment. You've got to be ready for disaster. But also that can open the door to different paths. And that's certainly been the case in my life, and I'm sure our listeners as well, and you. I thought it was a very insightful message. He's highly intelligent. He really is, which is not true of everyone elected to public office.
So to say the least.
Or everybody in academia, I might add.
Right. There you go. There you go. We'll, of course, eventually get to the hotly contested race here in the United States for who's going to be our next president. But I thought actually it would be interesting to talk about some elections in other places.
Sure.
And I know that there are a couple of very significant ones that that you wanted to talk about, including something that was a bit off of my radar screen, namely a very significant election which just occurred in Taiwan.
Yeah.
And I know that the column that you have just written, which I've not yet seen, points to the real significance of this election just held in Taiwan. Explain what happened and why it is so significant.
Well, Taiwan, like other major nations in Asia, including South Korea, has evolved from an authoritarian dictatorship to a democracy. The dominant party, the Kuomintang, the KMT, which has held the presidency under President Ma, is being succeeded by the DPP, the Democratic Progressive Party, a newer party, a party that is formally, on paper, committed to independence from China and being explicit about that. That's a big deal, especially from Beijing's point of view. The KMT, ironically, the more conservative traditional party, has been much more flexible, partly because of their history of direct engagement with the mainland and governance under Chiang Kai-shek. As I understand the history, they've been much more flexible in terms of accommodating Beijing. The new president also, most important of all, Tsai Ing-wen, she is a woman, the first woman president of Taiwan. That's extremely important. Really is, and should get more attention.
So can you explain precisely what the relationship is between mainland China and Taiwan at the present time. And of course, that's something that's been that has changed over the years since the late 1940s, where that split and exile, in a sense, sort of occurred. But at the moment, are we talking about two entirely separate countries, or one country in kind of a split format? Or, I mean, what is this relationship?
Two separate political systems for sure, but increasingly integrated economies. You're quite right, Greg. In 1949, Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai's communist military forces succeeded in their long-term revolutionary goal. They conquered the mainland and what was left of Chiang Kai-shek's beleaguered nationalist Chinese army. The remnants were able to make their way to Taiwan. And since that time, there's been, early on, for about a decade at least, it was a time of great hostility between the two sides. The general conventional wisdom was that, given the enormous size and scale of the Communist Revolutionary Movement, which had just seized the mainland, they would conquer Taiwan as well. And the U.S. government was prepared for that. Circumstances intervened in the form of the Korean War when North Korea invaded South Korea in 1950. The Truman administration quite rightly moved, I think, the 7th Fleet into the Taiwan Straits. And Taiwan, because ambiguity about our defense perimeter in Asia was seen as a factor in encouraging the invasion of South Korea, we declared very explicitly that we would defend Taiwan. It was also a poisonous time in American politics, rather like today. The fact that China had fallen this momentous loss as the Cold War was just unfolding led especially the Republican Party of that time, but not just Republicans, personified by Senator Joe McCarthy from Wisconsin. They accused the Truman administration of losing China. It's part of the not just ineffectiveness, but treason of the Truman administration. General George C. Marshall, who'd been a special emissary to China just before it fell, who served as very successfully as chief of staff of the U.S. military overall, in effect, Roosevelt's principal deputy during World War II. He was vilified, accused of being a communist. It really was, in retrospect, an hysterical time in American politics. Hmm. But understandable, in many ways more understandable to me than today. But that's the background. Since Deng Xiaoping, a very great Chinese leader, declared people's socialism in 1992 and started opening the economy to market forces of necessity, a big change for a dedicated communist. And since the mid-80s, when Taiwan started evolving into a democracy, there has been growing cooperation between the two systems. Mm.
Another election which has been in the news lately has been the election that was just held in Austria.
Right. I do think they will work it out, this, given the scare headlines and scare media, nonstop, electronic, unavoidable, given the alarmist pseudo-analysis coming forth in a lot of the media as a result of this election in Taiwan. Mm. I do think they will work it out. The DPP was
between the two.
Yeah, as they always have. The DPP was in power 2000 to 2008, I believe. And that was the first time they were in power. And the two sides worked it out. The growth of trade and investment in tourism is just phenomenal. There might be a war, but I think the odds are very, very heavily against it. There almost was a war twice, in 1955 and 1958. Things were very dicey. Eisenhower was so skillful that he kept one of those two crises out of the headlines almost completely. Mm. But it was at least as serious as the U.S.-Soviet confrontation over Berlin. It became a huge issue in 1960. Quemoy and Matsu, largely forgotten today.
Yeah.
Two offshore islands that were being heavily shelled by the Chinese army. The Kennedy-Nixon confrontation and very intense campaign, that became a major issue between the two. Shall we defend Quemoy and Matsu or not?
So this election of this DPP party should not necessarily be viewed as a radical new chapter in the relationship between mainland China and Taiwan.
No, not in terms of the traditional confrontation and complexity. In terms of gender relations, it's extremely important.
Yeah.
There is elsewhere for a woman to become president, all to the good, all to the good. Things go better when men and women work together on an equal basis. I tell the students and tell myself, and it really is important in that traditional Chinese context.
Right.
And it is a democracy. It is a democracy.
There was an important election just held in Austria in which a left-wing figure won a very, very narrow victory over what many regard as a rather extreme right-wing candidate. And part of what makes this story particularly interesting, beyond the context of Austria to whatever extent, you know, Austria itself is a significant player, is the fact that this apparently is part of a phenomenon we're seeing more and more across Europe, of a rise in prominence of right-wing figures who share in common, among other things, a real concern for, of course, this immigrant crisis that's kind of sweeping over the continent. What is your sense of this sort of rising political tide in Europe? Is that something that we should be concerned about? And what does it have in common with, for instance, the emergence and surprising success of someone like Mr. Trump here in America? Is it part of the same thing?
Of course we should be interested and inform ourselves, and we should be concerned. Adolf Hitler came from Austria initially, although his immediate center of power became Germany, where he rose. But any time there's a right-wing figure rising in Austria, a handsome former ski instructor many years ago who ultimately went over, this is the next Adolf Hitler. Uh-huh. Keep that in the back of your mind.
Right.
Right-wing nationalism is growing in Europe. It's not surprising. Their recovery from the financial crash of a few years ago has been very uneven and fitful. Unemployment remains very high, including in Germany, and what the economists refer to as structural unemployment in a much more restricted regulatory environment, I believe, is much more significant there than here, where it's tough anywhere to be out of a job, but we do have a more fluid economy. Right-wing ideologies, extremist right-wing movements, are more heavily embedded in Europe, including Austria, than elsewhere in Europe. They also are absorbing a very, very large number of immigrants, as everyone knows, I'm sure, from the headlines and the media. All of that puts pressure on these countries. Two points that are important. Right-wing movements are, by definition, nationalist. I'm not aware of any great coordination across national boundaries among these mostly ugly parties and movements, in contrast to the Socialist International or the Comintern during the Cold War and communist days. Secondly, we are a much stronger economy, and for all the political rhetoric, it's much more difficult for immigrants to get into this country, especially males from the Middle East, but from anywhere, as President Obama has pointed out from time to time. So we don't have the kind of objective pressures in this country that exist in Europe.
I was surprised. I wish I had in front of me, but the list of countries in Europe in which this phenomenon is being viewed, it surprised me a little bit because there was at least one Scandinavian country that was on that list. I might have been Sweden, but I'm not absolutely positive.
Sweden has reacted particularly strenuously and negatively, ironically, the great progressive country, from their point of view, in terms of closing off immigration.
Mm-hmm. So, for instance, someone you greatly admire, Angela Merkel, who is the leader of Germany right now, what kind of pressures is she facing or likely to face in the future from this rising tide in her own country?
I'm not sure how much it will continue to grow, but it's been a major challenge for her. There are very powerful right-wing elements in the CDU, CSU, Christian Democratic Christian Social Union, the very large party, which is her basic home. She's extremely good at keeping so far limited but virulent historically and currently right-wing nationalist forces in Germany, in Czech, in her parties. The CSU is the traditional home of residual authoritarianism and dictatorial attitudes in Germany. She may or may not survive. I do believe she's doing the right thing, both in terms of immigration and also economic aid and assistance for Greece and to a much more limited degree other countries in Latin Europe. But she has been pursuing what I believe are far-sighted and wise policies. But it's created a lot of grief for her politically. Mm. Her mastery as a politician is reflected in her long-term survival when there are lots of things that antagonize a lot of average Germans, by no means just immigration. I do think the traditional ties, strong ties between Germany and Turkey, they were allies in World War I, despite all the negative headlines about Turkey. I do think that's an ace in the hole for her in terms of giving her considerable leverage, not only with Turkey regarding refugees, but also indirectly with her colleagues in the European Union.
Hmm. Of course, one of the questions that remains, looms over Europe right now is what Britain's future is.
Yes.
in regards to the European Union. And of course, there are a lot of people not part of the European Union who nevertheless hope that Britain remains with the EU, and the United States is, of course, among them.
Yeah. President Obama recently visited Britain, and a major theme of his visit was the necessity for Britain to remain in the EU. Historically, Britain has never felt part of Europe in the same way that continental Europeans do. My first overseas educational experience was many years ago when I was working on my PhD dissertation, and I had the great good fortune to get a fellowship to spend a year in Britain. There was a lot of hostility to the U.S. because of the Vietnam War. I myself found British people, including young leftists at the LSE, people my own age, they were very, very friendly to the U.S. It's like we really were neighbors. And the Atlantic Ocean was of minimal importance. The English Channel was of great importance. They really saw the rest of Europe as quite separate.
Wow, isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
So precisely the opposite of what geography would tell you.
Exactly. You've summed it up quite well.
Huh.
They've always had mixed feelings about the EU. They could have joined quite readily in 56, 57 when the European Economic Community was put together. They did not. They tried to set up a competitive organization, the European Free Trade Association, which was kind of the geographically marginal countries of Northern and Southern Europe and Central Europe. That failed. Charles de Gaulle, the very powerful and very great president of France, made entry an ordeal. He turned them down in the early 60s, quite humiliating for Prime Minister Macmillan and associates. He turned them down again later in the 60s. They finally got in under Edward Heath in the early 70s. It's always been a fitful, complex relationship. They're not part of the common currency, the euro, like a lot of other countries. They are part of the common market. I think it's been advantageous for them to be given the financial importance, global and growing financial importance of London. Not just in terms of banking, but in terms of insurance, risk analysis, all kinds of financial industries and forms of commerce. Being part of the common market is extremely important for them, and if they left, I think they would be hurt. The big referendum in June will tell us. The Labour government in the mid-70s had a national referendum. There was a lot of indication in advance that Britain would withdraw, but ultimately the British decided to stay in. I personally hope they do this time as well.
Mm-hmm.
But related to the right-wing forces that you're describing, there's been growing nationalism, growing vexation with Europe in very immediate terms in Britain.
Right. Well, we'll make sure your visit in June comes in the immediate wake of that referendum, whenever it's going to be held, assuming your calendar aligns
sure.
with that.
No, I make it here every month.
We'll have that
just barely
conversation.
This month. Yes, thank you for getting in touch.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today on The Morning Show with Dr. Art Sear, one of the most familiar voices here on The Morning Show. He visits once a month to offer his analysis of current events. He is director of the A.W. Clawson Center for World Business at Carthage College. Professor Sear, we should turn our attention to both the Middle East and the Far East for important events which have occurred, including continuing turmoil, of course, in the Middle East, and the recent killing of Taliban leader Mullah Ahmad Mohammad Mansour. And what do you have to say about the turmoil in that particular incident?
There's always turmoil in the Middle East. I don't minimize the importance of current developments. It's therefore, I think, important to look at particular countries and not see it as one gigantic threat, especially one gigantic threat to us. The Taliban's a very durable movement, a very ruthless movement. There's no indication, as far as I know, that they're gaining any kind of popularity in Afghanistan. They're a very unpopular movement and always have been. I don't believe they control any single province in Afghanistan. At the same time, Americans especially seem to have a propensity to see one leader as pivotal or crucial. We're always killing people who are described as principal leaders of the Taliban or other terrorist and revolutionary groups. If they did, in fact, hit the target, and apparently we did, I think it's justified. It won't be a minus. But especially with revolutionary movements, it's important not to see one figure as pivotal.
Right. It's more like cutting off the one head of a hydra. And
very, very good imagery. Yeah, you're quite right.
I know that you wrote recently about the headlines made by OPEC recently and their failure to achieve what would have been an agreement to cut back oil production, which of course would be an aid to oil prices, which have been lower than they would want. So tell us more about this meeting which occurred in Doha, Qatar, and maybe what it says about the future and also what it says about our role, that is the United States, in the whole matter of oil production. It sure seems like there's been quite a dramatic shift compared to a decade or two ago.
Yes, certainly compared to a few decades ago. In 1973 and 1979, OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, mostly Arab countries but not completely, were able to impose very effective global embargoes and jack up the price like about 300% for basic processed crude oil. Inflation was already growing, thanks mainly to enormous fiscal deficits associated with the Vietnam War and the Johnson administration, and this greatly exacerbated them. Older listeners will remember, and younger ones might have seen videos of long lines of cars, very, very concerned motorists, anxious to make sure their tanks were filled.
I remember those days very vividly. I wasn't even driving yet, but I remember that so clearly. It was scary.
It really was. And in a fundamental sense, if someone, especially in the unstable Middle East, could cut off your basic supply for our economy and society, it's like air and water.
Yeah.
You need gasoline. That was disturbing. They tried to do it before in 1960. It was, I believe, the first time OPEC had tried to pull something like this, and they failed because into the 1960s, the U.S. was still a net oil exporter. There's cause for great optimism because of the failure of the most recent meeting. A lot of the members were determined to reach an agreement to control production and cut back production given the plummeting in oil prices. Russia participated in the meeting. Iran did not participate in the meeting. Very, very significant. And I think indirect testimony to the wisdom and effectiveness of our nuclear agreement with Iran. An important point, because I'm sure it's going to play a role in the fall presidential election. Russia was hoping that they might increase their own influence. So they attended the meeting. The failure to reach agreement is really very good news, especially because thanks to controversial fracking, which has become commercially viable in recent years, a process of hydraulically driving petroleum to or near the surface, the U.S., which is a major leader in this field, I believe we're now a net exporter of gasoline, and pretty soon we'll be back to where we used to be, a net exporter in oil. It gives us enormous strategic leverage with all kinds of countries, including Russia, including Venezuela, which continues to be a headache for us, and others. It really is very, very positive news, I believe, and I wrote about that. There is a nun in Iowa who writes to me from time to time. Usually she... Her emails are favorable, and I thank God for that, not just joking. She was really upset because I seemed to be defending fracking, which is a controversial process because it's environmentally damaging. That's a major consideration. It's not just the cloud of big oil. The fact that fracking is commercially viable and also can stay generally within the U.S. government's environmental guidelines that has made this a feasible process. It's been around for a long time. Nazi Germany was a leader in development of synthetic fuels and also processes for getting the last ounce of oil out of the ground. The U.S. and Germany remained leaders in this field after the war. The first actual fracking process was developed, I believe, in the Midwest of the U.S. in 1947. So it's been around for a long, long time. But people could not make money with this process until recently, and also the environmental damage was so great. We haven't loosened restrictions, quite the contrary, since the 40s. But it's, I think, going to continue to grow in importance in the world, not just for us.
Well, we'll watch that with great interest,
it's really
of course.
Important because it's not much discussed. It's sufficiently complicated and sophisticated that it doesn't lend itself to scare headlines in media. You know, the media apocalypse, which is 24/7 and nonstop in our life.
In the Far East, of course, a couple of big news headlines. One of them, President Obama's visit to Vietnam and the lifting of the arms embargo against Vietnam, which had been in place for quite some time. One of the important stories kind of embedded in that particular story, in a sense, a larger story, is of Vietnam's rising prominence as an economic power in this part of the world. What can you tell us about that?
I think it's a remarkable transformation. The importance of market economics is particularly strongly demonstrated. It's a country that, in contrast, for instance, to South Korea, they have not had the opportunity to really develop an unfettered market economy. I think, I'm not an expert on that part of the world, but I think that the enormously long period of their revolution, not just their war against us from the 60s, but the long, very brutal revolutionary war with France, which went on from the end of World War II into the mid-50s. And before that, Japanese occupation has limited the opportunities for rapid economic growth. They also have seemed to have had great difficulty, and quite apart from communist dictatorship, the powerful revolutionary culture has been very, very slow. An ideological culture has been slow to transition to a more open economy. I think that has had something to do with their very long revolutionary past. Now, mind you, North Korea is still an isolated communist dictatorship. But in the distinctive case of Vietnam, I do think the long-term revolution has made things hard for them. I also, historically, I do know this for a fact, very direct experience fact, the commercial strength historically has been in the southern part of Vietnam. Military dominance historically, and we're talking about several thousand years now, has been in the north. there really are differences between these two regions, a fact that tended to be overlooked by people who were against the Vietnam War during that period. And I think the tension, the fact that the talent was mostly in the South where the Chinese population was concentrated and is, I think that's made it difficult for Hanoi. I first went to Vietnam, North Vietnam, in 1994. Mm-hmm. I went to Hanoi on a personal trip. It was not easy to get there, but I found it very, very rewarding and very, very satisfying. The it was, by design, it was well-timed. We were building a large program on Asia, the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations, starting with Japan. The economic embargo had just been lifted. President Clinton was moving to recognize Vietnam. Ambassador Peterson, our first ambassador, had not yet arrived. So things were coming off economically. The regime was desperate for investment, for contact with the West, strong economies, even the United States. I saw very senior people in the foreign and economics ministries in Hanoi because they wanted to, not because I was important, but because they wanted to see any American who was a good source of contact. It was really a very, very interesting trip, and early on underscored to me how what an opportunity there is for leverage over Vietnam in economic terms.
So it must be an extraordinary thing for you to see this kind of agreement now all these years later.
Yeah. Well, we've had, again, they've had a hard time getting off the ground industrially, commercially, and they've been struggling for many, many years. But I think the president's visit is all to the good. Obviously, the White House is thinking in balance of power terms as competition and some conflict grows with China. In good old balance of power terms, they want to emphasize Vietnam, a traditional enemy of China, and Japan, another traditional enemy of China.
Right. You mentioned North Korea, by the way, and wrote a column not too long ago, which ended with the kind of chilling words, the noose is tightening. Uh-huh. You were referring, I think, among other things, to the fact that the United Nations recently voted to actually escalate sanctions against North Korea. Uh-huh. In the meantime, you tell us that they held quite an elaborate pageant, we might say, an enormous Communist Party Congress, you said, quite carefully choreographed and so on.
Yeah.
North Korea always manages to find its way into the headlines, doesn't it?
Yes, indeed. Kim Jong-un, the current tyrannical leader of the North, but at the same time a kind of cartoonish figure, he wore a business suit for this kind of phony orchestrated celebration, which appears to be his way of indicating that they are also anxious for foreign investment and desperate for foreign trade. They have been quite incapable of actually opening up their economy in a way that would encourage that. But they don't have these party congresses very often. The last one was a few decades ago when his father, Kim Jong-il, was installed as leader. Right. So they are significant.
Do I remember correctly that you said that actually in at least one of the speeches he gave, he acknowledged the extreme economic difficulties there in a way that is somewhat uncommon?
Yeah, that's right. Even the secluded, isolated family cabal that runs the country from Pyongyang, even they are being forced to face the reality that things are really god-awful in their country. Hmm. Not for the elite, of course, but for the people at large.
Right.
And there is a growing black market. Social media is becoming steadily more, with great difficulty, more visible in North Korea. Vietnam has tried very harshly to censor the internet, like comparable to China. Censor the internet, censor social media. Apparently, it's very hard to do this in terms of any kind of really total control. And I've been interested to read in the media in connection with President Obama's trip that there are bloggers just like you. There are, you know, information is getting out in Vietnam thanks to social media. And, of course, the more they open up the economy, the more this will be the case.
Right. I just read an interesting article, and I actually didn't thoroughly read it, so I probably shouldn't even attempt to summarize it or quote it, but an article about how evidently the Chinese government has been engaged in a very concerted effort to produce tens of thousands of social media posts for the sake of propagating certain opinions and perspectives, but trying to pass them off as the authentic utterings of just normal Chinese citizens, but just a widespread, whole scale attempt at in a sense infiltrating social media with their own very self-serving message, but again passing it off as something being expressed by and believed by ordinary citizens. I found that to be fascinating. I mean, but again, a sense kind of a, if you can't beat them, join them sort of thing.
Well, that's communism. The two principal Soviet newspapers, Pravda and Izvestia, during the Cold War were targets for jokes by the Russian people, by the populations in the Soviet Union, because of the cynicism about state organs. China seems to be a much more collectivist society and has been much more malleable to communism, but the same fact of life applies. You're quite right to point that out.
Well, let's finish out, if we can, probably with not sufficient time to explore all that is worth talking about in terms of the political landscape in this country and what is shaping up to be a couple of very dramatic conventions, although in a sense now it's starting to look like the Democratic convention could be, in a sense, the more divisive one rather than the Republican, although there's certainly the potential on both sides. Must really be extraordinary, given that in recent years, these conventions have not been anything like that. I mean, scarcely anything significant has been contested in a convention in some time.
That's right. That's a big change in American history. Ronald Reagan did, in a very daring way, challenge a sitting president, though not elected president, Gerald Ford, in 1976. That really was exciting. The Reagan people came very close to breaking open the convention, but Ford never lost his bare majority of delegates. The last truly contested conventions were in 1952. Neither Dwight Eisenhower nor Adlai Stevenson, I believe, were the front runners when the conventions opened, but they both ultimately won as the nominees. That was a long time ago. There's no indication, unless there's a real revolution somewhere, that either convention will be that way in terms of the front runners lacking a majority.
Right. Well, it's going to be an interesting thing to see how this all plays out. Of course, most recently, in just the last couple of days, some poll numbers have been released that showed what seems to be a surging Donald Trump, and did seem to point out the persistent difficulties of Hillary Clinton, who nevertheless remains the front runner. Among the interesting things that were said on NPR about this yesterday was the matter of that these are just poll numbers; they're just a snapshot of a moment, and that the predictive qualities of poll numbers is extremely limited. So I'm guessing you will agree that, you know, we shouldn't be looking too far ahead because of a poll number that's taken today. Nevertheless, do these numbers matter? What should we be looking at here?
No, your earlier point is right. NPR was right. No surprise there, of course, to you and me. When someone locks up the nomination, they get a bounce. John McCain in 2008 got a bounce. Mitt Romney in 2012 got a bounce. Neither one, of course, won the election. Presumably, former Secretary and Senator Clinton will get a bounce when she is finally confirmed as having a majority of the delegates. It's important to be particularly skeptical today because we not only have pervasive media we have pervasive polls. An ABC Washington Post poll, I believe, has become particularly visible because they show Trump and Clinton basically locked in neck and neck in a dead heat. These are news organizations. We have a phenomenon today where news organizations run polls. Then they turn around and their news staffs use those polls to make news. This is what is described as conflict of interest. Once upon a time, young fellow, conflict of interest was extremely important, not only in American politics and American business, but American life. Today, I believe we've gotten so far away from that that conflict of interest is pervasive. For-profit companies that draw on nonprofit and educational institutions, where they overlap in terms of staff as a way of making money, that happens to be against the law. But especially today, the IRS is so besieged and so defensive that they're not going to make an issue of that. That's one example. The political campaign is another example. We have pervasive conflict of interest in America today. The regular person, the regular woman and man, should be particularly suspicious, especially about anything media-related where there is conflict of interest.
Right.
Not long ago, the Washington Post would never, ever have engaged in anything like that. ABC News would never have done anything like this. CBS, in a very different America, the corporation made a lot of money because ruthless Bill Paley saw that legitimate news, reliable news, separated from any conflict of interest, was what the people actually wanted to hear. Good old Walter Cronkite, within a half an hour, was able to actually deliver the news, not speculation, not hype, and that's the way it was.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And, of course, polling in itself is a difficult science and more and more difficult to do given the preponderance of cell phones now versus landlines and so
that's
on. So
right.
There's all kinds of ways in which you can call poll numbers into question.
Yeah, it's very good to look at methodology. It's very good to look at methodology. My understanding is, in evaluating any particular poll of the endless polls that we have today, my understanding is that the best of the organizations in this business have done a pretty good job with internet polling. That works pretty well in getting a sense of the people. With cell phones, I think all bets are off.
Right. And, of course, the other number that we tend not to pay enough attention to is that all of this is ultimately about the Electoral College. So even if it turns out that the popular vote is relatively tight, ultimately what matters the most in terms of who will be our next president is who is going to be ahead in the Electoral College, which is a little more complicated matter, and it doesn't tend to make the headlines.
No, that's right. It used to be controversial, but apparently not so much in our time. In 2000, of course, the popular vote went one way. Al Gore had about 500,000 more than G.W. Bush, but the Electoral College, aided by the U.S. Supreme Court, even more removed from the people, basically made the decision, and there was no great popular protest against that. As we were coming out of the revolutionary period of the Great Depression and World War II, the Electoral College was very controversial. And there was a big debate in Congress in the 50s about the Electoral College, and a relatively unknown senator by the name of John Kennedy made a very, very well-researched, very impressive speech defending the Electoral College, which tends to confirm the winner. Winners do have some foresight. In 60, it was basically a dead heat between Kennedy and Nixon, ultimately. Kennedy wound up being about 120,000 votes ahead with less than 50%. There were a few minor party candidates. But the Electoral College, with a Democratic vote concentrated in big industrial states of that time, the Electoral College gave it to Kennedy. And I think that's part of what the founders had in mind, a way of not having direct democracy. They seem to see direct democracy as dangerous for some reason. Wonder why. They also saw it as a way of kind of institutionalizing victories removed from the direct immediate vote. fascinating subject.
It really is.
Yeah, I can tell I'm on NPR when we're talking about the Electoral College.
Right. Well, and we'll talk about that and plenty of other things when you return to us in June. In the meantime, I'm so grateful to you for joining us today on The Morning Show, Dr. Art Sear. Great to have you here, as always.
Thank you. Feelings mutual, Dr. Greg Berg.
And you can visit The Morning Show archive if you want to revisit a program or hear